feed Egypt, so allow him to do it, please. How stories are told in Matthew, since he's trying to help the church in this battle with the synagogue, he's going to sharpen and he's going to stress any conflict with the Pharisees. I shared with you that Matthew has a deep understanding that Jesus is Lord of history. So he's going to drop any reference to the human traits of Jesus. Jesus doesn't get flustered. He doesn't get frustrated. He doesn't get tired in Matthew's gospel. Matthew is stressing the divinity. Jesus is Lord. If you could just put the accent, because nobody can get it all together. It's too impossible. Mark has Jesus is Lord. Matthew has Jesus is Lord. Matthew accents the humanity to stress the... Mark accents the humanity to stress the dying. Matthew accents the lordship to stress, hey, Jesus is over it all, don't worry. He'll take care of us. So he drops all the human traits. And then I shared with you how Matthew changed that story to show Jesus healing. In Matthew's gospel, it is very important that Jesus comes with three missions: to preach, which leads to healing. Preaching means God's kingship is here. God's kingship means God wants to break into your world. Translated in our words, that means Jesus is here for you right at this moment. If you accept him, that leads to healing. It starts. But it's never complete. And so there must be teaching. And the teaching leads to more healing. These are the missions that Jesus has. We're told that in chapter 4, and we're told it again in chapter 9, and it's very intense. Very important there, 9 or 10. Right after we're reminded of the three missions of Jesus, Jesus gives two of them to the church. He tells the church to go and preach and heal. And it isn't until 18 chapters later, the very last paragraph that I quoted to you a moment ago, does Matthew tell the church, now go and teach. Because by this time, the church is experiencing the resurrected Jesus. And Matthew is telling us, listen, until people have experienced my spirit, don't teach them. And until you've experienced my spirit, you can't teach because you don't understand yourself. I can send you out to preach, and your preaching can lead to healing, but you're not ready to teach, and you're not ready to be taught. When I sent the 12 out, they weren't able to preach, to teach. I sent them out to preach and heal. Only after I had died, risen, and given them my spirit, and they experienced all that I am, were they able to teach. Matthew is aware of that. Healing, therefore, it's all aimed at healing. And the teaching brings about deeper healing. So Matthew is communicating a Jesus who lives. A Jesus, now Matthew, as I said, is a very organized person, so he super organizes the whole thing. This Jesus is the new Moses, creating the new Israel. And a Jesus who cares, and he doesn't want us to be hurt because we're being thrown out of the synagogue. So he speaks to our immediate problem. We don't have that problem today. But those charismatics who were thrown out of the Southern Baptist Church could find great comfort in the gospel according to Matthew. Jesus could speak to them with the very real problems that they were having. Mark and Matthew and Paul, to simplify, see two ages to history. There's the Old Testament and Jesus. Jesus has brought the end of time. It started, but he hasn't completed it yet. Jesus is resurrected. Now we're simply waiting. Jesus is sort of... He's up taking a cat nap in heaven, and as soon as it's over, he's going to come back and he's going to finish what he's begun. And then it's all over. And that's right around the corner. So there's a brief period of time given the world for everybody to accept what Jesus has begun, and it's going to end any day now. That's the view, pretty much, of Mark and Paul and Matthew. Luke. has a very different view. Luke doesn't write just a gospel. Luke writes two books, and you got to take them together. He writes the gospel and the book of Acts, because Luke sees three periods of history. The period before Jesus, and that's told in the Old Testament. The period of Jesus, and that's told in the gospel, and the period of the church. There's a third era to history. We're not just biding time until Jesus returns. We have a very real purpose and a very real mission. This is one of the three great ages of history that our loving Father has designed. It gets its meaning from Jesus, but we are his extension. We're carrying on his mission. We're not people who are just waiting. Right in the beginning of the book of Acts, there's the question, men of Galilee, what are you standing around looking up to heaven for? Don't you know that this Jesus that you've seen going up is going to return? So don't look up. And then ultimately, there you find out why, because you've got to go back to Jerusalem, be filled with the Spirit, and carry this message to all the world. You've got a mission, and that's Jesus talking to us. Luke experiences a Jesus who says, listen, you've got far more to do than let me love you. You have mission. You have a mission today. You're important. And it's got to be shown from this whole thing. This is really one work split into two parts. And you've got to see it. Boy, the organization of everything changes then. Now, in presenting Jesus, I use the word with Mark, but it's nothing compared to Luke. Luke presents Jesus geographically. Geography is it. You gotta see geography to understand. The first part, the gospel, has everything coming in to the city of Jerusalem. The book of Acts starts with Jerusalem and has everything spread from there to the rest of the world. That's how Luke presents Jesus. He uses geography. He starts with Galilee, pretty much after his introduction, the way Mark did. He takes Mark. Then Mark talks about that journey to Jerusalem. That's a major part of Luke's gospel. Everything, 90% of the material that Luke wants to add, he adds on that journey. Jesus makes them, that's the gospels we've been reading the last few Sundays in the church have all come from this part. Jesus makes a major journey to Jerusalem. The phrase is, when the time came for Jesus to be assumed from this earth, he set his face firmly on Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a mission. It's dying. It's Jesus accepting an act of death on our behalf so that we might be saved. And nothing will cause Jesus to look away from that. So he starts heading to Jerusalem. If you read the gospel, then it becomes ridiculous. Luke had never been in Palestine. He has no idea of the geography. And Jesus could really have used AAA. Because he just makes one of the most ridiculous, firmly setting his face on Jerusalem journeys you have ever heard, just stumbling all over the place, up and down. But Luke doesn't know this. And Luke just wants Jesus in mission. And then when he reaches Jerusalem, very suddenly, in the course of a few days, Jesus dies, he rises, and in Luke's gospel, all of the resurrection appearances occur in Jerusalem. None in Galilee, because he won't break the geography. This is where I told you that they will change facts to teach theology. Jerusalem is sort of the heavenly Jerusalem. It's going to be part of his whole teaching. Luke knows without any doubt that Jesus appeared in Galilee. Now, he isn't going to allow that to happen at all, because that would break the whole order. How can you have everything go up to Jerusalem, shift scenes over to Galilee, come back to Jerusalem, and go from there? The book of the Acts of the Apostles has the disciples in Jerusalem, Jesus with them again. He ascends, fills them with his Spirit, and then slowly his Spirit starts spreading the mission until it reaches Rome, which is the center of the known world. And the mission of Jesus, therefore, is going everywhere. And that's the whole story of Jesus. It's all one. Jesus unites them both. The church is an extension of Jesus' Spirit. The Spirit of Jesus, the same life force acting through us, as he acted through his physical body here. So it's one great mission presented to us through the framework of geography rather than of any of the other ways, like five booklets or a passion with an introduction. Luke knows that it's all going to everybody. So Luke has the strongest understanding that Jesus has his mission for all people. So when we say, what does he select and omit? He selects Mark, the stories, the collection of sayings that he puts in one big part, and some of his own parables. He omits anything that's upsetting. He doesn't have any time for getting around controversial points. So anything that sounds a little bit icky, he drops. That doublet in Mark, well, that's kind of weird. Why did Jesus feed 5,000 and then 4,000? So the great omission comes because he has no time to take Jesus through the same, over the same ground twice. Jesus is on a real journey. He doesn't have time to backtrack and go through the same area again. So he selects this way. How does he put things? Geographically. That's his big organization in both works. And you got to see the overall geographical framework, not getting confused with the little stumbling around in the journey following a map, because Luke had no map and he didn't know what Palestine was really like. How does he tell things? I want to show this a little bit in telling the stories. Let me give you some facts. I'm going to bring John in a little bit, John and Luke. If I were to ask you, when did Jesus ascend? All of you who know a lot would say 40 days after he rose, because that's when the Feast of the Ascension is celebrated. If I were to ask you then, when was Pentecost, when did the Spirit come? You'd say on Pentecost, which is 10 days after that, 50 days after Easter. That's Luke, and it's Luke alone. If you read the Gospel of John, Jesus rises on Easter Sunday. He then tells Mary Magdalene, he appears to Mary, and Mary falls at his feet, and he says, Mary, don't cling to me, for I am in the process. The Greek says, I am in the process right now of ascending to my Father. Right after that, he bops in on the disciples, and he has a whole meal with them. So presumably they can touch him, so the ascending is done. And he looks at them, and he breathes on them, which means he inspirits them, which is Pentecost. So ascension and Pentecost occur on Easter Sunday in John. They do in Matthew, probably. Or they do very quickly. Maybe not on Easter Sunday, but not 40 days later. Matthew has Jesus appearing to the disciples in Galilee. It doesn't take them too long to get there. And then he says, full authority, when he's appearing to them. Certainly Pentecost occurs at ascension for Matthew, because Jesus says, full authority has been granted to me. That means I'm ascended. I have it all now. That's what the ascension means. It doesn't mean Jesus disappears. It means he has the fullness of God, the glory. It's really all his to use. Full authority has been given to me. And then when he says, go, that's Jesus giving his Spirit his authority. You're going with my authority. You go now as my apostles, as my agents. And the Hebrew notion of that is, if you go as my agent, I am you and you are me. So you now have my Spirit. So it happens very quickly in Matthew. Mark doesn't have one in the original gospel. Luke has him. Luke in his gospel, you want to really see something. Luke in his gospel has the ascension occur right after Easter. Then you start the book of the Acts of the Apostles, and it's 40 days later. They're being done for theology. John is trying to tell us that there's one great continuous action. Jesus says, if I be lifted up, and he means, if I be lifted up on the cross so that I can be lifted up from the grave, so that I can be lifted up in glory, so that I can give him my Spirit. If I be lifted up, I'm going to draw all men to myself. Look, John is trying to tell you, if you look to Jesus lifted up, if you really look to Jesus, he's saving you. So it's to show the one great sweep, that they're not three great events. It's one event. Luke is telling us about Jesus no longer appearing physically. John is talking about the glorification of Jesus occurring so he can give us his spirit. Luke is really saying, listen, Jesus did stop his physical appearances. Luke is trying to pull together on a specific day after Jesus spends 40 days. Now, 40 days is sort of, that's a very biblical number. That's all that's needed. That's a round number. Jesus, after he rises, spends all the time that is needed to continue preparing the church. He then ascends. The church prays. Luke is a big one on prayer. So you better prepare yourself now for what Jesus is going to do. So 10 days to do this, and then you get the Spirit. And he does it on Pentecost because Pentecost is a Jewish feast celebrating what happened at Mount Sinai, the birth of God's people. With the Spirit, the new people of God is being born. So that's why that extra 10 days also is thrown in. That moment, the Spirit comes down. What does the Spirit do? He undoes Babel. Man's pride built a tower that caused everybody to babble, speak different languages. When I'm going from selfishness and pride, I'm talking a different language from you. The Spirit of Jesus is a spirit of love. And when two people are filled with love, they're speaking the same language. Pentecost Sunday, Peter comes out and the others, and everybody from every different country in Jerusalem can understand what the disciples are saying. The separation of Babel is being ended by the love of the Spirit living in the church. That's the teaching that's going on. So we're being taught theology. We're not being taught history. When did Jesus ascend? I don't know. When did the Spirit come? I don't know. I don't care. Jesus is in glory and I'm with him. That's important. The ascension of Jesus means heaven has begun now for me. Pentecost means the Spirit of Jesus is mine and I don't have to babble. I can talk a language you can understand because Jesus is speaking a language I can understand. That's the theology. I hope you can see this now. You don't read for history. Don't look at what happened in the life of Jesus. Try to understand what the living Jesus is doing. One, either Luke or John changed facts. I've got a bigger one that I'll give you in a short while of a fact being changed. In a very short while on John. So, we talked about how stories are told. He'll shape the events to teach theology. So we do get to the last one, John, then. John uses a completely different framework. He doesn't use Mark at all. So we don't really know too much about what he selects and what he omits. We know what he selects. We can't really be too sure about what he omits because he's not, you know, we can't go to Mark and say, well, he dropped this from Mark or he added that from Mark. What John does do that none of the others does is he gives us a prehistory. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he tells us that everything's created through this Word, and nothing has come to be that didn't come to be through this Word. And then he quickly summarizes all of God's dealing with his people, how the Word came unto his own, and his own didn't really accept him. The light shone on Israel, but Israel didn't want it. But to as many as did, he gave the power of becoming sons of God. But this didn't really work. Then the Word becomes flesh. So we hear that the Word is enfleshed. And nothing more after that. Prehistory and then public ministry. But this is done very, very differently. You get a book of signs and a book of glory. That means passion. One very big thing. They'll change things. Jesus, if you want to be correct and understand Jesus, Jesus is crucified in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Jesus hands over his life in John. So deep, so fabulous. Nobody can take the life of Jesus, for he's Lord. The crowd comes to him in the garden, and Jesus says, who are you looking for? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. He says, I'm he, and they fall backward. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, it just sounds so stupid. It happens three times. You think they'd give up. But there's deep theology being taught. That crowd can't touch Jesus. He's Lord of history unless he gives it the power. The moment that Jesus dies, the Greek says, in John, Jesus hands over his spirit to the Father, yes, but also to us. In other words, all of his life force is handed over from his body, and there's nothing in the body. That's telling us what Jesus is doing. His life isn't being taken from him. Jesus isn't reluctantly giving us anything. He is, in love, emptying himself of all that he is and handing it over to us. So John will change the description of the crucifixion to teach the real theology, to let you know what Jesus is doing for you, that it isn't reluctant love that he's offering you, but free love, and that he takes the initiative, and it's full love, and from his heart flow water, water a sign of the Spirit, come to the springs of life, and blood, blood the sign of life. The Spirit of Jesus is being offered you from his heart. His heart is being emptied for you. Eugenia Price does such wonders with that, that there's no mystery to God because his heart has been bared and his heart has been emptied. That's, I believe, the strongest thing she taught me from that book, What Is God Like, that I recommend so much to you if you have the opportunity to kind of read. So, also, Jesus has a 3-year ministry. The Book of Signs is based on miracles that Jesus works and then sermons that bring out the meaning of them. That's a summary. Jesus kind of works 7 miracles, and they all have a symbolic importance. Jesus feeds the only one. Well, there might be others, but the clearest one that is taken from Matthew, Mark, and Luke is that Jesus feeds the multitude. Following the feeding of the multitude, there's the great bread of life discourse. Jesus says that he is the bread of life, and he's referring first to his teaching, and then he goes through it a second time, and he refers to the Eucharist, to his meal. Jesus is the bread of life, and if we fill ourselves with that life, we're never going to hunger. We're never going to cry out insecure. We're never going to yearn for more love if we allow Jesus to love us, if we turn to him for satisfaction. So the real meaning of the feeding in the wilderness is brought out in the bread of life discourse. And there will be again and again instances where Jesus does this in the Book of Signs. Jesus gives a sign and then interprets the sign for us to understand. Then with the Last Supper, you have the Book of Glory. The hour has arrived when Jesus begins to love his own completely and to show the glory of the Father. He's at the Last Supper. There's no need to give the words of institution. We don't hear how he created the Eucharist. That's been taught already in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In its place is first the great symbolic action where Jesus lays aside his glory. He puts aside his robe. He picks up a servant's robe. There's a Bishop Sheen is the one that made me aware of this. There's that great hymn that Paul says, though he was in the form of God, he did not deem equality with God something to be grasped onto. Rather, he emptied himself. At the Last Supper, Jesus doesn't cling to his dignity. Dignity is very symbolically in the New Testament shown by robe. The saints are those who have washed their robes clean in the blood of the Lamb. Outwardly, they're clean. The inwardly, is they're living the Spirit of Jesus. Jesus puts aside. He doesn't cling to the glory of God. He puts it aside. And he comes. He did not claim equality. Rather, he grasped equality. Rather, he was born in the form of a servant, being born as man. So Jesus puts on a servant's apron, picks up a basin, and he humbled himself, Paul says. And Jesus humbles himself, and he goes around and he starts washing their feet. And that's how Jesus continues to act, John is telling us. Listen, you want to know what Jesus is doing? He's kneeling in front of you now saying, let me wash you clean. And Peter says, Peter's going to stand on pride, not me, Lord. And Jesus says, well, if that's going to be it, you can't have any part of me. You know, we want to wash ourselves clean. And Jesus is telling us, if that's the way you want to do it, you're not going to have me, because you can never wash yourself clean enough to merit me. But you don't have to, because I'm begging you to let me do it. Let me wash you with my Spirit. That's the fabulous part of the Last Supper. And then Jesus has his great high priestly prayer. 4 chapters, a 4-chapter fabulous sermon. at the Last Supper, praying that all would be one, praying that we would have his joy, praying that we would know his glory, praying that we would be where he is, praying for the world, praying for those who will believe through those who believe. The Spirit of Jesus is just echoing its own thoughts so clearly. So this is the book of glory, the Last Supper, and then the Passion and the Resurrection. And most clearly, the Passion is told sort of as a drama, with scenes inside and scenes outside. Inside a court and then outside in front of everybody, alternating. And what really happens is, the world is trying Jesus. The Jews do, and Pilate does. And in trying Jesus, the world is on trial. And in condemning Jesus, the world condemns itself. And this is exactly what Jesus says in John's Gospel. I haven't come to judge anybody, but to save. Those who refuse to believe are already condemned. Those who refuse to believe in me condemn themselves to live away from me. By trying and condemning Jesus, the world is on trial and it's condemning itself. And that's one of the ironies that John shows in the gospel scene. Jesus keeps his dignity through it all. He does die, but rather, much more important, he hands over his spirit. So it's a very different selection of material. It's kicked around a lot more. You have just a very few miracles with long, very deep sermons in the first half. The second half, you have that long, deep collection of the sayings of Jesus from much greater insight at the Last Supper, and the trial shown in a different way. Things are put in a completely different order. Book of signs, book of glory, lasting over a long period of time, and it's all told to show that Jesus is replacing everything that the Old Testament had. The very first miracle of Jesus at the marriage feast, the Jews had a way of purifying themselves. They had water jugs put out, but the water jugs are empty, and therefore the Jews really couldn't purify themselves. And so it's true to say that they have no wine, which is what Mary comes and says. And Jesus produces a superabundance of the best wine. He's replacing the purification rites of the Jewish faith. Mary has no mission when Jesus says, "What is it to me, woman, and to thee? My hour has not yet come." Jesus is telling Mary, you don't have a role yet. It isn't till he's dying and his mission is complete, he and he alone saves, that Mary's mission begins. And at that moment, Jesus says, "Now, woman, look at your son." In John's Gospel, Jesus refers to Mary as woman, and it sounds harsh to us unless you understand that's the word for Eve. She's the new Eve. Your role hasn't begun yet in the book of signs at the marriage feast, Eve. That's mine. I do it all as the new Adam. But the moment I've started my new creation, then you do have a mission to take my disciples, take the beloved, that one who has most loved me, and let him become the first of your new sons, born from my spirit. So John is just changing and teaching. It's all theology to understand what's going on, not history. The Old Testament is used to deepen that theology. That's briefly looking at these three standards then. You got to read a gospel from start to finish. If Matthew didn't think something should be put here to help understand Jesus, he wouldn't read it. He wouldn't have read it. He wouldn't have written it. I just get furious when we have readings on Sunday that drop parts out. And this will happen. You know, they'll give us a selection and we'll read like verses 1 to 4 and then 7 to 8. If Matthew wanted it read that way, he'd have written it that way. That's distorting Jesus as Matthew experienced it. I just see red. And I get so mad when we drop. The best what we should do is start one and read it to the end. Start the next, read it to the end. That's how it was written. He selected. And what he selected for a reason. He put it in this order for a reason. It builds. You know, those 10 miracles, take one out of order and you're missing some. And then he tells it this specific way. Mark will tell it a different way. We're going to take a look at that. Now there's some general conclusion from all of this. You can't, please don't combine details, which is what everybody else did. When you combine what you know of an event from Mark, and you bring in what Matthew said and get some more, and then what Luke said, and then pull in something from John, you end up with one story that doesn't communicate anything about the living Jesus. That's how you write lives of Jesus that are inaccurate and that don't communicate Jesus. I'll show this. The most famous story that I've discovered is what we call the temptation of Jesus. In Matthew's gospel, you might remember, Jesus comes through the water and he goes into the wilderness. He's in the wilderness area 40 days and he's fasting, and the devil comes and asks him to turn bread into food, and then the devil asks him to throw himself from the pinnacle of the temple. That's impossible because the temple had no pinnacle, incidentally. These temptations are not historical. Matthew is telling us, well, that the early Israel, during its 40 years in the wilderness, faced these same three temptations and failed. The new Israel, Jesus, is experiencing inside himself the same temptation to try to get great acts of power, to presume, to force God to help, and to seek for power in the world, to win all kingdoms. And Jesus turns down all three temptations. He's not going to tempt God. And he's not going to live on bread alone. He's not going to grumble because he's hungry. And he's not going to do anything for all the kingdoms that are in the power of the devil at this moment. So Jesus is tempted. You pick up Mark's gospel. Jesus is filled with the Spirit. He is driven by the Spirit into the wilderness, where there is a trial. Now you've read Matthew, so you can now fill in. That's all Mark says. And angels come and minister to him, and the wild beasts are with him. Well, the best thing to do, since Mark doesn't tell you what happens there, is fill in the details of Matthew. And if you do it, you lose everything that Mark is teaching you, and you distort it. Mark is a completely different teaching. Jesus is not tempted in Mark at all. He's filled with the Spirit, and because he now has the Spirit of God, his mission is to win back God's, well, to defeat disorder, to defeat chaos and bring order back. And disorder, chaos, results from the forces of evil. Jesus goes to those places where you're going to find the forces of evil most strong. Wherever there is order, there is God and the devil, and calling the devil symbolic of everything representing forces of evil won't be found. So where you have God, there you will have everything going great and you won't have disorder. Now where there isn't life, where there isn't abundance, there isn't much of God, that's where the forces of evil are. So you go into a wilderness area. Go into a garden, God's there. Go into a wilderness area, God's absent, that's where evil is. Jesus goes looking for the devil to clobber him, not to be tempted by him, but to find him and to kick him to hell where he belongs. Tell him to go to hell and, you know, give him a kick to get him on his way. That's literal. So that disorder will be thrown out of the world and God's people will be saved from disorder. Now, Matthew is telling you that when you are tempted, if you will allow the Spirit of Jesus to be in you, that temptation can never conquer you. There's no temptation in the world that can overcome Jesus, and you're part of him in the new Israel. Mark is telling you that Jesus just doesn't wait until somebody starts assaulting you and you call upon him. Jesus takes the initiative, and Jesus is at work with his Spirit inside you before you ask for anything to root out chaos. He's battling for you. This is why the Father sends him, to battle your battle, to find those areas of chaos. And if you just stop stopping him, he's going to be victorious. It's a completely different presentation. And the angels minister to him so he can keep up his battle the way they ministered to Elijah with food. So he's not fasting in Mark. The angels are bringing him food for the battle. And the wild beasts are with him. That's a way of saying that the chaos of nature is ending. Isaiah said that during the days of the Messiah, a lamb and a lion would play together, and a baby could play with a snake, and wild beasts are with Jesus in the wilderness. So chaos is being defeated, and the same can happen for you. You lose the meaning of the full story in Mark if you bring in the details of Matthew. The same would be true for almost any other story. So first, please, for your sake, don't combine details from another story. Read only what is written here. Secondly, put the story in its place, in its context, to see its full presentation. As I shared with you, Matthew puts 10 miracles in a row. To just read the miracle alone is to miss some of the overall presentation. Mark had many choices, but he puts the stories in a specific place. He ends the first cycle of the feeding with the miracle of stammering, the second cycle of feeding with the miracle of the blind, Jesus giving blindness. Both of these are very important in a prophecy of Isaiah that the Savior is here. This helps us understand that Jesus is saving us. In those 10 miracles that Matthew lumps together, he's doing something else. He's putting together miracles that are right off a checklist in Isaiah to tell what's going to happen when the Messiah comes. The blind are going to see, yep, Jesus gave blind. The deaf are going to hear, yep, Jesus gave, it'll enable a deaf man to hear. The poor are going to have the gospel to preach to us. We just heard Jesus preaching to the poor. He enabled a paralyzed person to walk, so the lame are going to leap like a staff, and the dead are going to come back to life. Hey, you know what? Jesus has gone through the checklist. He must be the Messiah. And when John the Baptizer says, listen, Jesus, you're not saving the way you should. I expect you to come with fire and to burn out God's enemies, and you're loving the sinners. Are you the Messiah? Jesus doesn't say yes. He says, you go back and you tell John, the blind see, the lame walk, the deaf hear, the poor have the gospel preached to. Are you wondering if Jesus is saving you correctly? He's not coming with power to clobber your enemies. He's not coming with power to change your husband, to change your neighbors, to change your boss. Is he really the one who's saving you? Take a look in your world. Jesus is letting those who are blind to really see the beauty of God. Those who are deaf to hear the words of love that are giving them dignity. Those who are crippled and haven't been able to walk, he's healing them. So they're walking through life with smiles on their face. And some who are totally spiritually dead are most alive. Look at what he's doing, and you'll know the Messiah is active in your world. So the way Matthew organizes the miracles has another meaning also. Not just looking backward to Jesus being Moses, but looking also to Jesus being Messiah, Jesus being one who saves. Take an isolated miracle, you'll miss it all. Put it in its sweep and be open and allow the Spirit of Jesus to keep touching you, and these points will be coming through. Read the story for an understanding of Jesus, for Jesus is first in each story. Don't read the story for a message. The example, since this is what I've got to do, and if I can't do it, I won't preach on Sunday. I take a story and I keep kicking it around until I understand Jesus, not a message. The Martha Mary story, what was the message of Jesus there? And it finally dawned on me the real message. Isn't it stupid to have, you know, Martha's off in the kitchen cooking, she's upset because her sister Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus. And Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you're so anxious about many things. Mary's chosen the better part and it's not going to be taken from her. Well, that sounds like a message, you know, and then this is where other priests will have different views. Some people talk about the active life, those who work. Some talk about the contemplative life, those who pray, and that Jesus is saying this is a better one, hogwash. There was no contemplative life in the time of the early church. When this is written, there is no such thing. So that isn't really it, although you can read this into it, and yeah, you could say some have to work in the world and some got to pray. But that isn't Jesus. You're getting a teaching. You're not finding Jesus first. We've got to always get back to that center circle, going back to our first class. We've got to always come back to the good news. The good news is Jesus, not a message. And it finally broke in on me. Isn't it dumb that Martha was trying to feed the bread of life? Isn't that pretty stupid? And isn't that what we try to do? We try to do good works to make Jesus happy, to win him. Mary had it all right. She just sat at the feet of Jesus and let Jesus feed her with his teaching. Because that's what one of the ways the bread of life feeds. That's the message. Jesus is the bread of life. Stop trying to save him. He's here to save you. Stop trying to feed the bread of life. Don't come to church on Sunday to feed God. He's invited you to his meal to feed your emptiness. That's an important teaching about Jesus. He feeds you. You don't have to feed him. Similar one would be the Good Samaritan. Start with the parable. You can find out you're supposed to have care for everybody. Well, I don't like to have care for everybody. That makes the good news bad news. I don't want to hear that parable. Bury it. Rip it out. Unless you remember that the original Good Samaritan is Jesus. And that's how he's dealing with me. I get beaten up. And I'm laying around the side of the road of life. And so many people pass me by and they don't care. And I'm hurting. And I'm really hurting. And Jesus stops. And he uses oil and he uses, what was he anointed? Two things. He uses the anointing and he uses feeding or something. There were two things in there, in the phrase, that both would apply. The anointing is baptism and the other was something else. Two sacraments are really referred to the way Jesus ministers to me. And he takes me to the end of the church. Jesus doesn't care when he starts his ministry. I'm not supposed to be fully healed. He brings me to his house. And he doesn't give me, hand over two coins for people to care. He hands over to the church his whole spirit and says, here, keep feeding them with this. He's weak yet. Now, when I know that Jesus is the Good Samaritan caring for me this way, and I'm filled with this care, then I can go to others. That's what we got to do. You got to break through what you're reading until you discover Jesus. The Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek. That's how Jesus deals with you. When you remember this, that Jesus will never be mad at you. No matter how many times you slapped him in the face, he loves you. Then you fill yourself with that love. Then you might be willing to carry that love to others. Break through. If you're getting a teaching, you're not going far enough. Teachings burden us always, usually. Maybe not you. But when I learn something new I'm supposed to do, that's just another new burden. You know, I flunked what I was supposed to be yesterday. Don't tell me more I'm supposed to be today. That's just going to give me more standards I can't meet. But that isn't the way it works. Always we're getting Jesus. And then when we get Jesus, we got the good news. When we got the good news, we'll be living it. Finally, I'd just like to share with you, if you can quickly put it all together, there were three different levels to any story. What happened historically? What the early church, so that's what Jesus himself did, what the church remembered, and what the gospel writer writes. So we just say what Mark writes. It's easiest to see with a parable. Jesus tells a parable. He tells it with a specific meaning. The church might remember it for another meaning because circumstances change. And Mark can give it a third meaning depending upon exactly where he puts it in his gospel. Now, when Jesus tells it, it's the Spirit of Jesus telling it. When the church remembers it, it's the Spirit of Jesus helping the church remember it and color it a little bit. And when Mark writes it, it's the Spirit of Jesus here. So all three are valid. And we can enrich the meaning going to all three levels. Jesus told a parable. The time is probably going to run out. I may not get it all in. He tells a parable about a farmer who goes and sows his field. I'll tell it in Enid terms. A farmer who sows his field puts in his winter wheat, and there was no rain that whole fall. There was no snow during the winter. It was a terribly windy winter. Sub-zero temperatures and winds almost every second day of at least 50 miles an hour, and boy, that wind just cut through and so much of the seed blew away. In the spring, there was almost no rain again, and the winds got heavier. And the farmer went in and he harvested his crop and he got 400 bushel to the acre. Now that's the story that Jesus tells. And the message that Jesus is saying, listen, don't get discouraged. You can't stop the kingship of God with worldly problems. The yield's just going to amaze you. The church remembered that parable, and then it made it an allegory with every point having meaning. The seed along the path. See, when I said 400 bushels to the acre, the normal yield in Palestine is 70, is sevenfold. You get seven bushel at this time. You got seven bushel for every one bushel of seed. The yield here is 30, 60, and 100-fold. And 100-fold compared to 70 is a wheat yield of about 400 to 500 bushel to the acre here. The church gives meaning to each point to let people know, listen, you better not let the world come and lure you away. So the explanation of the parable isn't from Jesus. That's a sermon the church gave on that parable, guided by the Spirit of Jesus. Then Matthew put that parable in a specific place to let you know something. When Matthew puts it and Mark where they do in the gospel, they're telling you, you don't understand Jesus. Jesus himself is a mystery. The seed is mysterious unless God reveals it. So there's a third meaning to the collection of parables. So, and the same thing can be for anything Jesus does. He worked the miracle, the church remembered it, and Mark uses it in a different way, or Luke. Jesus works a miracle because he loves, the church remembered it, maybe because a pagan was involved. Mark uses it to help introduce Jesus feeding the pagans.